Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're calling for this afternoon's case, 048P1252, Julie Mayer v. Trollhagen Ski Resort. Representing Julie Mayer is Michael J. Bros. And you have ceded 10 minutes of your argument to the Amicus Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers. Okay. We will then, who's it? William Geisner. Geisner, I'm sorry. Then we have 20 minutes, Todd Kobach, who has ceded 10 minutes to the Amicus Wisconsin Builders Association, representing the Amicus is Stephen Keene. And 5 minutes for Michael Bros in rebuttal. Is that the correct order? All right. Mr. Bros, 15 minutes.
Madam Chief Justice, honorable members, may it please the court. My name is Mike Bros. I'm from New Richmond, Wisconsin, and I represent the plaintiff appellant Julie Mayer in this matter. The issue for the court's consideration is whether the 10-year statute of repose contained in Section 893.89 impliedly creates immunity against safe place claims on behalf of owners of public buildings. It's our contention that if the court adopts the reasoning of the Court of Appeals and gives to Section 893.89 the reading that the Court of Appeals has, that it will effectively repeal Wisconsin's safe place law for structural defects that exist in every single building in this state that was built prior to 10 years from that decision. And thereafter, no owner of a public building will have any legal incentive to inspect for structural defects or repair structural defects. And it is our contention that that is against both the policy and the language of the Safe Place Law, as well as the statute of repose that is in question. I'll begin my comments about this by discussing what I believe to be the language and purpose of the Safe Place Law. Section 1 of 101.11, Wisconsin's Safe Place Law, imposes upon the owners of public buildings three duties, and that is to construct, as safe as its nature will reasonably permit, those buildings or other edifices. The other two are to repair and maintain those buildings to keep them as safe as their nature will reasonably permit.
Can I stop you? I'm wondering if you have set forth properly the Court of Appeals decision. The Court of Appeals decision says that to the extent your claim is based on defective construction, it's barred. That the Safe Place statute imposes an ongoing duty to furnish a safe building, so it's the duty has three parts, construct, repair, and maintain. So it doesn't say that the original construction is forever barred from being a Safe Place statute, but that there's a flaw here because of lack of notice.
I respectfully disagree, I guess, with the Court's reading of the Court of Appeals decision. I read the Court of Appeals decision to make two determinations concerning the case. I think what the Court of Appeals said is that with respect, he is segregated,
right,
as the Berry case had not too long in the past. The Court of Appeals is segregated and made a distinction between structural defects and unsafe conditions associated with the structure. With respect to structural defects, the Court of Appeals acknowledged that there is this ongoing duty under the Safe Place Law to inspect.
Right.
There is the duty to construct safely, and then there's an ongoing duty to inspect for the structural defect. But what the Court of Appeals said is that the statute of repose is going to bar any claims for those structural defects as soon as 10 years has run from the completion of the building. That's number one. Number two, then, what the Court of Appeals said, and this is what Your Honor is referring to with respect to the notice issue. Number two, the Court of Appeals said, if the plaintiff's claim is construed as one having to do with an unsafe condition associated with the structure, mm-hmm. per Berry decision, mm-hmm. It has to be demonstrated in addition that there was notice provided to the owner of the building so that they could do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Court said, I guess as a matter of just judicial fiat, the Court looked at the record that was before him, and the Court said that it is my opinion that there is no evidence of notice to Trollhagen in mm-hmm. this case, and therefore, no matter how you characterize this case, structural defect case or
I agree with what you've said so far.
Pardon me?
I agree with what you've said, but then the Court said the owner has a continuing responsibility to repair and maintain, and then it went on to say, well, okay, but under the repair and maintain, that the owner didn't have actual constructive notice. Are you going to argue that on summary judgment, this was summary judgment, wasn't it?
Yes.
Going to argue on summary judgment that there's nothing in the record on actual notice or constructive notice, and then because of the age of the building, there is constructive notice.
I agree.
I read the cases.
I agree, and I take issue with the Court of Appeals decision concerning the notice issue. What I'm asking this Court to do is to grant me the same remedy that was granted in the Berry decision as to the notice issue, and that is to give me the opportunity to present that issue to a jury.
Okay. Let me ask, has your claim heretofore, that sounds pretty fancy, has your claim heretofore been one solely for structural defect?
Well, I think at the time it was pled, to be perfectly frank with the Court, I didn't draw the distinction in the pleadings. It was pled out as a safe place case. But I agree with the Court of Appeals' decision to the extent that it could be construed one way or the other. I think that's part of the problem with the Berry analysis, is that distinction can be difficult to make. In this case, you know, the defect we claim certainly was constructed and designed and put in place at the time the building was constructed, and to that extent, if you use the Berry analysis, it was a structural defect. On the other hand, it could be construed as an unsafe condition associated with the structure because it is isn't necessarily the location of the drain itself. It's that the stall for the bathroom created a traffic pattern across the drain. And it seems to me that all Trollhagen would have had to do is sometime during that 30 years prior to this accident is noticed that the doorway that they subsequently erected across that drain area creating that traffic pattern was a mistake, and that they could have put the doorway on the other side of the stall to prevent the problem from occurring. And so to that extent, it could be construed as an unsafe condition associated with the structure, as Judge Peterson noted in his opinion. I just disagree with him that they didn't have notice.
So let me get back to Berry. The way that Berry defines structural defect or a condition associated with structure, is your case a structural defect case, or is your case an unsafe condition associated with the structure case?
The trial court said that my case was a structural defect case.
What do you say?
I'd say that it is more appropriately considered to be an unsafe condition associated with the structure. But I feel obligated to respond to both, given the Court of Appeals' decision.
Where, if you're able to, and I'm not, because I can't pick it up this quickly, but Berry defines what is structural and what is an unsafe condition associated with the structure.
Yes.
Fit your situation into the Berry definition, if you're able to.
The way I have summarized that from the Berry decision is that a structural defect is equal to an unsafe condition at the time of construction.
Right.
and that an unsafe condition associated with the structure are things being out of repair or not maintained.
Right. That's what Barry says.
And I think it is close. I think it can be argued either way. And I think it's difficult. And I'd like to present it to a jury, quite frankly, in alternative terms. Don't know if the trial judge would permit that, but that's what I think is a logical thing to do. But if forced to elect, and if the court saw it my way, I would say that it is out of repair because of, and it's not properly maintained, because the door to the stall directs traffic across an area or a unsafe condition.
Now, here you're taking the position. Now, has there been any change in the structure since in the last 30 years? It's been there, as I read the facts, there's been no change.
True.
So you would like to, and I understand because I think that there is a difference, obviously, in safe place structure, one that may be in need of repair, but under the 893-89, your opponent seems to, your opposing counsel makes the point that now this is clearly structure because it has existed, and the reason for the statute of repose is to put some limitation, 10 years. Are you saying that 893-89, as far as structural defects, that you would say that it could have a statute of repose?
Only with respect to the construction, and I need to clarify that a little bit. I think, and what I'm saying is this, the owner who is associated with the actual construction, that is, he is meeting with the contractors, he's meeting with the architect, he's meeting with the plumbers, and he's participating in the decisions about the structure, how wide are the eaves going to be, where are we going to put this drain, that sort of thing.
Is that an assumption? Do you know that the owner did that? He might have bought the building. I mean,
in this case, the facts are that he was.
Okay.
To that extent, he was involved in the construction process. I think the statute of repose relieves him from his negligence in that regard. The statute of repose does not, and this is with respect to structural defects, which I understand your question to ask, the statute of repose does not relieve that same owner from his ongoing obligations under the safe place statute to inspect. And I think there are two reasons for that that are contained in the statute of repose itself. First of all, in the language of the statute, the body of the statute of repose, incidentally, obviously, it's an immunity statute to be construed narrowly. But that statute of repose indicates that no cause of action may be commenced, and then you read further down the statute for the modifying language, arising out of defective construction. So the statute of repose, as I indicated earlier, would relieve then the owner for his involvement in the construction process, not the ongoing duties to inspect and so on and so forth under the safe place. Secondly, under the statute of repose, there is an exception found in subsection 4C, which provides that 893.8 does not apply to negligent maintenance, operation, or inspection. Which I contend, if there was any doubt about what the body of the statute meant in terms of not applying to safe place obligation, clarifies that matter to suggest that even with respect to structural defects, that owner's ongoing responsibility trumps it in the statute of repose.
He had the duty to inspect as people went through the doorway and had to walk over the drain. Right?
Yeah, and to observe in the use and the patterns of people, and with knowledge that they're in ski boots and there's going to be wet conditions and all that stuff, that it would have been reasonable. That's a back question, ultimately, I'd like to take up with somebody else, but yes.
Rose, could you paint a more complete picture for me of exactly what this recessed drain was like?
Yes.
How big was it? How deep was it? What was the angle of the floor?
Yep. There's confusion about the record. I don't think it's very clear. It's a flat cement surface, the entire bathroom. Yep. And then there is a floor drain that is about 3 inches in diameter, or 3 inches, yeah, 3 inches in diameter, and it has a metal grate across it. Around the 3-inch metal grate, there is a recessed area about as big as a manhole cover. In other words, the cement is concave going down into that 3-inch metal grate. So we've got a bathroom, oh, it's twice the size of this table in front of us, and then there is, in this corner, traffic pattern leading into the lady's stall, there's this 3-inch grate with a recessed cement area about as big as a manhole cover. What the client testified to concerning her accident is that she came out of the lady's stall and that she stepped not into the recessed cement area, but onto that metal grate itself. The problem, she contends, and when you read in the briefs and other submissions concerning the depressed nature of this area, is that that metal grate itself sits beneath the recessed cement area by about 3/8 of an inch, and that when the heel of her boot hit that metal grate area, she was, in her words, unfooted by that, and it is her belief and our expert's belief that if it had been at the same level of the bottom of the recessed, of the bottom of the sloped cement area around it, that she would not have had that slipping effect.
There's been actual measurements recorded in the record. If it's
3/8 inches, not. I'm supplying that for His Honor.
Well, let me ask this. I have not looked at the record. Are there photographs or diagrams in the record?
I don't believe so.
This was summary judgment, so they're probably just affidavits or depositions. Is that it?
Yeah. My memory might be faulty in that regard, whether we supplied a photograph to Judge Gail Weirich or not. But
it's a record. That's the record. There's been no trial here.
There's no trial. There's summary judgment.
It might be that this is perfectly well-maintained. That's what a jury could find.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Could be that a jury would find this is okay. It's not individually obtained.
You bet.
You just want to get to trial.
Exactly.
Now, if you get to trial and this is a structural defect, this is the same question Justice Wilcox asked, I think. Do you think the 10-year statute applies?
No.
You don't think so?
No.
Okay.
Because it does with respect to Mr. Rockford's participant, Mr. Rockford is the owner of Troy, with respect to his participation in the construction, but not with respect to his ongoing duties.
Okay. Well, I would have answered that, yes, 10 years applies to the structural issues under 893-89, but not under 4C to negligence in the maintenance, operation, or inspection. Because that's one not covered under 893-89. So as I read the Court of Appeals decision, which you don't have to read that way, your construction count, which was, I think, count one, is out by the 10 years. Your second count, which recites the safe place statute, is in, but you lose because there was no notice. That's how I read the Court of Appeals.
Fair reading, I think.
Okay. And your count under the 101.11 is Trollhagen Ski Resort violated the state of Wisconsin's safe place statute. The above describes damages were approximately caused by the failure of the defendant to, and here you have, design, construct, or maintain. Okay? That's what your pleading was.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think my time is up.
Yes, it is, but you'll have 5 more minutes for rebuttal and questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Gleisner, representing the amicus.
Madam Chief Justice, honorable members of the Court, may it please the Court, I'm Attorney Bill Gleisner, appearing today on behalf of the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers, and the Academy wishes to thank Mr. Brose for graciously agreeing to share some of his time with us today. We submit that the key to this appeal can be found in Cohen when this Court stated that under current 893-89, owners and occupiers are protected only so long as they are involved in the actual improvement of real property. Based on Cohen, we believe that 893-89, in effect, creates two classes of public building owners and occupiers. One, those owners and occupiers who act as builders, and two, those owners and occupiers who have a continuous, absolute, in the words of this Court, non-delegable duty under 10111 to make a building as safe as reasonably possible for the public. An owner or an occupier might belong to both classes, but will have different duties as a member of each class. And I think it's important to note here that the respondents have conceded that the Safe Place Law would apply to them up until at least 10 years after the construction of the building. We submit respectfully that there are two problems with the position taken by the respondents in opposing amici. First, their position does not take into account all of the provisions of 10111. Particularly, I'm referring to 2A, which provides in part that no employer shall fail to do every other thing reasonably necessary to protect the life, health, safety, or welfare of, among others, frequenters, and no employer, owner, or other person shall hereafter occupy any place of employment or public building that is not safe. With regard to 893.89 sub 4C, we do not think that this represents a subtle legislative attempt to repeal any facet of the Safe Place Law. The legislature was well aware of our century-old Safe Place statute when it drafted 893-89, and we submit it is because of their concerns for our Safe Place Law that it was at pains in two previous efforts to exempt owners and occupiers from its coverage. At the same time, the legislature knew from Kellis and from Funk that it had to add owners and occupiers to the list of those covered under 893-89 if it were to achieve a constitutional statute. The legislature was attempting to make clear in sub 4C that it had not forgotten our ancient Safe Place Law. But at the same time, by adding 4C, it created a serious ambiguity when 893-83 is compared with 10111, which we believe must be resolved by statutory construction. We would like to rely on the statute.
Ambiguity.
I'm sorry, Justice.
What's the ambiguity?
The ambiguity is that there is an apparent conflict between 893-89 and 10111 with reference particularly to sub 2A. I cite in support of that one of the cases cited by opposing amici, the Belangi case, at page 11, where they state that courts need to harmonize statutes and, quote, repeal by implication is not favored in the law, and statutes of general application must give way to those of specific application, close quote. Consistent with Belangi, Justice Prosser said in Landis versus Pick, and I quote, in interpreting statutes, a court must attempt to give effect to every word of a statute so as to not render any portion of the statute superfluous. We submit that the position taken by the respondents in opposing amici. Yes, Justice.
I want to focus on that because I'm not sure there is a conflict, and I want to ask you about that.
Yes, Justice.
Can you have a construction defect? I don't want to use the word structural defect because of how it's defined in Barry. But can you have a construction defect that does not render a property unsafe?
I think you can, Justice. And an example I would give is we're talking now about two classes of builders, two classes of owners and occupiers. As to the owner and occupier under Cohen who also participates in the building, imagine, if you will, that an owner and occupier participates in the construction of a condominium association, and a number of years afterwards, say 12 or 15 years afterwards, it's discovered that there's a defect in the roof of the condominium association, which doesn't render it unsafe, but it still would be a defect. It would be a construction defect.
And 893-89 would therefore, the statute of repose, would cover that situation.
I believe it would, Justice.
But it wouldn't come in under the Safe Place statute.
I believe that is correct because the Safe Place statute as this Court has said in a number of cases going back to 1913, interpreting 101.11 sub 2A, has said repeatedly that owners and occupiers have an ongoing continuous duty, which is absolute and non-delegable, to make sure a building is safe. So that if we're talking about an unsafe structure as opposed to a construction defect such as the one we were just talking about, I think that 893.89 goes too far if it applies there, because an unsafe building might otherwise be continued ad infinitum after 10 years had passed. But if we're talking about a construction defect, such as a roof that's not safe or a foundation that leaks or something such as that, 893.89, I think, would apply to the construction that was done by the builder and owner participated in.
Tell me, it seems to me that breaking it out in the fashion that you have in some ways renders the 10-year statute of repose with regard to the person participating in the building, the structure, renders that almost superfluous. Who cares, I say, who cares if they built it, you know, or part of the structure in building or design? Because if they have a continuing duty, then it renders any 10-year repose statute with regard to structure superfluous. Can you respond?
I would like to, Justice. The fact of the matter is that the construction process itself is subject, I believe, that was the point of Cohen, to 893.89, but it, in exempting just under 4C, the negligence of a owner or occupier of the property with regard to maintenance and so on, it cuts too narrowly, because 2A clearly applies to all buildings where there's an unsafe condition. The architects, the builders, those people who, as the opposing amici has pointed out quite correctly in their brief, are the ones who, for whom the statute was originally passed, they're in good shape because they have left the building, so to speak. They are no longer subject to any obligations, and after 10 years, their liability ends. An owner or a builder does have protection under 893.89 to the extent that he or she participated in the building process. But the important thing that we want to emphasize, we don't want to see the 100-year-old safe place law of this state, which this Court has so eloquently defended from 1913 down to the present in Barry. We don't want to see that compromised. We think that an owner or occupier of a piece of property who is participating in the building process is subject to 893.89, whereas an owner or occupier who wears a different hat and is in effect owning or occupying a property that is unsafe, his obligations don't end after 10 years. In fact, his obligations each day begin anew, ad infinitum. He has an obligation, an absolute, non-delegable obligation to make a place safe.
Now, the safe place statute does not always need negligence, isn't that right?
Absolutely, Justice, and in fact, that is the point of the decision of this Court, and I reference you specifically to the Zernwick case, and 21 Wisconsin 2nd, 164 at 170C.
Okay. All right. Here's my question.
I'm sorry, Justice. I apologize.
I'm setting you up.
Oh, okay, Chief Justice.
Under 4C, the 893.89 doesn't affect an owner or occupier for damages resulting from negligence.
Correct.
In the maintenance, operation, or inspection of an improvement to real property. So what I'm asking you, if you come under 4C, if that's your argument, then there has to be a showing of negligence.
There definitely has to be a showing of negligence.
Are you arguing that the Safe Place statute for a cause of action that doesn't affect negligence is also out from 89389?
My time is up. May I reply?
Yes.
I am saying, Chief Justice, that we're talking apples and oranges.
Okay.
If we're talking about an owner or occupier who is or has participated in a building process to the extent that he is responsible for construction.
I agree with that. That's under 89389. Now we have an owner and occupier. 10 years have elapsed.
Right.
And there's been no change in an allegedly defective condition.
Yes, Chief Justice.
Okay. But there's no negligence.
No negligence.
Right.
And there are a number of ways, Chief Justice, that a building could become unsafe 10 or 15 years down the road. For example, Chief Justice, say a building was built 15 years ago by an owner or occupier as an ice rink, and then it was drained. Nothing has changed in the structure, but the use to which it has been put has changed. And also, Chief Justice, what about asbestos?
All right, let's take the ice rink. Liability or none for personal injury?
I missed you. I'm sorry, Chief Justice.
Is there liability in the ice rink that's been changed?
Yes, there would be.
Without any showing of negligence?
I believe, Chief Justice, that if it turns out to be unsafe, for example, it's used by a indoor farmer's market, and it turns out to be unsafe for the users of that or the frequenters of that market, I believe that under 2A, Chief Justice, without regard to negligence, the owner or occupier has a duty to make it as safe as reasonably possible for the frequenters of the property.
Okay.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Thank you, Court.
Counsel. Mr. Colback, representing the ski resort.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, fellow justices. May it please the Court. My name is Todd Kodak. I'm an attorney with the Terwilliger Law Firm, and I am representing, in this case, I have the privilege of representing Trollhagen Ski Resort and its insurer, its liability insurer, American Home Assurance Company. The issue in this case is fairly complicated only by the briefs. As humorous as that sounds, as I was preparing for this conversation with you today, I was struck by two things. One, I was struck by the fact that this fills up at least 2 file drawers at my office and that it's been sufficiently briefed on every angle. The other thing that struck me when I was preparing for this conversation is that at its heart, the issue here is actually fairly simple. The undisputed facts in this case are basically that Trollhagen Incorporated is actually the proper name of it, was involved in preparing preliminary designs for this bathroom drain that's in a ski chalet it was building in the 1970s. If you look at Jim Rochford's deposition, which is part of the Kobach affidavit in the record, it does say that Trollhagen was involved in the preliminary design. So you do have an owner and an occupier here involved in the designing and construction process of not only the ski chalet, but the bathroom. There were some questions I believe Justice Prosser asked about. What does this drain look like? I don't believe there are any pictures in the record. I don't believe I submitted any. However, if you look at a deposition from Larry Sieberlich in the record, at least at page 53, he describes that it was a flat floor, but from the plane of the floor, this actual recess dropped down about 2 inches, so that would give you the slope of that. And I believe on the earlier pages in that same deposition transcript, which Attorney Brose put in by his affidavit, he also describes that the whole recess area was about the size of manhole cover, like 24 to 36 inches. The recess drain itself, the metal grate, was slightly below the bottom of this sloped area by about, I think, a half inch or 3/8 of an inch. And that's also in the Sieberlich deposition, so if you need to consult those facts, there are no photos, but there are some detailed measurements there. Spinning off that, the thing to keep in mind here is once this drain was built, Trollhagen did not modify it. It was not changed. It stayed the same. What they did do was daily they would have someone inspect that bathroom, including the drain. Someone would clean it. Floors were polished. At some point in the early 90s, I believe it was November 92, they had a non-slip grip surface put on the bathroom floor. There is also in front of this bathroom a grate where someone with ski boots can wipe off snow before they go into the bathroom.
Counsel, you started your comments telling the court that the issue was fairly simple.
Sorry, and I did.
Okay, and I just want to steer you back to that because I want to see what the simple issue
sure.
is.
The issue in this case is the claim against Trollhagen and its liability insurer is that Trollhagen, for safe place purposes, they negligently designed this bathroom floor and the drain, and they negligently constructed it. Now, there was some inference in the initial complaint that they also negligently maintained it for safe place purposes. But all the facts that you saw come in on the summary judgment motion and the affidavit of Todd Kobach show that Larry Sieberlich, Julie Mayer herself, all focused on the location of this drain in the pathway and also the depth of the drain at the slope and the little recess, and also the actual slope of the floor. So these are all design and construction issues. The reason that's simple is that whether you call them structural defects or whether you don't call them structural defects, the fact of the matter is if you turn to 893.89 subsection 2, you'll see that that statute says that any cause of action that creates an injury to a person that arises from a defect or a deficiency in design, planning, construction of the improvement is subject to the 10-year statute of repose.
And that simple issue is?
Simple issue is whether it's a safe place claim or not, it arises from design and construction, period. It is barred by the builder's statute of repose, 10-year period.
Okay, suppose this was a lack of maintenance. And so in maintaining this drain, et cetera, it was unsafe. Would 893.89 bar it?
If it was a lack of maintenance, I would say no. And the reason I would say that is this. If you look at the Berry factors, which this court came up with in, I think, 2001, there are delineations for the types of safe place claims you're dealing with. One is structural defects, problem with the design and construction.
Which you say this is?
Which I say is circumstances.
Right, okay.
The next category or tier would be unsafe conditions associated with the structure. Basically, where what you have built has now failed because it's fallen into disrepair, it's dilapidated, for whatever reason. In that circumstance, you run into a notice issue, but more importantly, there is a part in 893.89, it's the subsection 4C, which says if the owner fails to maintain that, and that's why it's become disrepaired, dilapidated, then the owner's liable for that. But that is a set of actions or failures occurring subsequent to the actual completion of that improvement. 893.89 deals with the improvement itself, what was involved in the design, the construction, and if that is what the case involves, 893.89 serves to bar it. That's what this case involves. If you look at the affidavits in the trial court record, which there wasn't much, you will see that there's no evidence that Trollhagen failed to maintain this bathroom. Everything that came from Trollhagen showed that they did daily maintenance and inspections. That was not rebutted by the plaintiff who had the statutory burden.
This is my problem.
Okay.
And I need your help. Your argument is, let me give a little hypothetical. Your argument is, let's say the building was built in 1980. I'm an owner. I buy it in the year 2000. Let's say there's a structural defect that's open, use language of the yesteryear, open, notorious, and without a doubt unsafe. Okay, so those are my facts. As an owner, I would have no obligation to do anything about that. I would be immune from liability under your argument.
Not necessarily. Not for the first 10 years.
Okay. Well, I purchased it, remember, in the year 2000. It was constructed in 1980, 20 years
and
ago.
And I think there were some questions, or at least some comments, about what would be the incentive for a property owner
that's
here.
That's part of what my question is, because as I see your argument,
I would be immune from liability, so I don't care how dangerous it is. It might be costly to repair. I'm immune under your argument.
You're immune only in the legal sense.
Okay. Morally, I'm guilty, and I may not
be accountable,
but I'm talking not about that here. Under your legal argument, I am immune from any liability for damages.
That is how I understand 893.
That's what bothers me. You know, set my morality aside. How can that be that if I buy a building and I'm the owner and it's past 10 years of age and it is clearly dangerous, dangerous to little kids, people in wheelchairs, and old women and men, I can say, who cares? I'm immune. I don't care how much they get injured. I'm immune. It doesn't seem to me like that's what the legislature could have intended.
It doesn't seem fair, but at the same time, that's almost a bit of a far-fetched hypothetical. Someone buying a property is going to do an inspection. They're going to want to make sure it's safe, especially if they're turning it to a public building or a place of employment. They're not going to want to have a place where their employees are constantly falling and breaking their legs so they can pay workers' comp, or their customers are falling and getting hurt. There are business reasons why, if you're going to buy a building like that and take that chance, you'd want to fix it.
Let's take this building right here, and let me just draw the facts a little differently. Let's say, rather than the lip difference between the level of the floor and the grate, rather than 3/8 to a half inch in difference, let's say it is 1 inch. Boy, that'll get them. And let's move it to, 1 inch, I won't even move it. I won't move it to any other building. It's this ski building. Seems to me that anyone that wears something other than ski boots, maybe, and even people with ski boots, might trip on that. I mean, if I went in there with high heels, it'd be a real problem if I weren't really careful in looking. So my concern is that people buy buildings with dangerous conditions that maybe, they inspect, but for reasons, who knows, they don't catch it in the inspection, or they don't want to pay for it, and why should they? I mean, they're immune. They have no liability whatsoever. Why should they even care about correcting a exceedingly, and I'm, exaggeration for emphasis, exceedingly dangerous condition?
My response would be, if it's an exceedingly dangerous condition, it wouldn't exist. It would not be there, because in the first 10 years that exceedingly dangerous condition existed, there would have been numerous falls, numerous accidents, numerous lawsuits, and the first owner who built that improvement would have fixed it, because if it's that dangerous, it would not be there 10
years
later.
When I was a circuit court judge, I had a Safe Place case, and I can't remember all the facts, but it's kind of interesting. And that is, these facts that we get in cases are stranger than fiction. They're always funny. So here you got a place of employment, and the employer sends the workers every once in a while up to the attic area. And I can't remember if it was a false ceiling. I think they were just 2x4s, and there was really no floor, another, underneath that than was just the ceiling, if you will. And so the workers were, correcting something, and periodically they'd have to go up there. I mean, that's not a safe place of employment, sending these guys up clear up high. If they take a misstep off the beam, they go 20 feet below. But it happens, I mean, so it seems to me your response of, well, if it's unsafe, it would be impossible to exist because people are morally responsible,
Maybe I should address it a slightly different way. I would think that if that hypothetical case happens, where it is an extremely dangerous condition that has somehow lasted beyond 10 years of liability, business reasons for changing it, all of that, and it's still there, you buy that property as a second owner, do you have any incentive to change it? No, because I believe the builder's statute of repose protects you. Is that unfair? Absolutely. However, that's a public policy determination that the legislature has made. Unfortunately, it's not my job to change that. If I don't like it, I call up my senator or my assemblyman and I say, look, you got to fix this. But as it stands right now, I believe the plain reading of the builder's statute would bar that. And is it unfair? Yes. So are all statutes of repose and statutes of limitations.
Well,
What about 4C? This repose does not apply to negligence in the operation of an improvement to real property. And in Justice Bradley's case, the first worker falls. Well, first, we won't make him a worker so we don't get under a worker's comp. He falls. 10 years are in. The argument you would make is you're protected. Okay, the second owner is there. 20 years have passed. Second person falls. Is that negligence in the operation of an improvement to real property? And let's just say he is negligent. Because anybody looking at this would know that's unsafe.
The way I read 4C is it has the three parts to it. There's the inspection, the maintenance, and the operation. Maintenance, if you're negligent in maintenance, it's because you were supposed to fix something, supposed to repair something, and you didn't do it. It's a failure to act. To me, operation, and I looked this up in a dictionary a couple nights ago just to kind of prepare for this, operation is a verb that implies the exact opposite. You affirmatively are doing something that's negligent. In the Trollhagen case, let's assume that they were operating their ski lifts one notch faster than they were supposed to be. It's an improvement that's being negligently operated. Here, you're not operating a floor drain.
You're certainly operating this building. You open the doors, you close the doors, you inspect it, you change the floor, you add grip surfaces, you send in janitorial service to clean the bathrooms. If you're not operating the building, I don't know what is operation.
And I think the way I read it in 4C is because it refers to the operation of the improvement. Now, I believe by that reading of it, yes, you can operate a building or you would operate a business.
You don't read improvement as being the building?
I think it's the improvement that's at issue. If it's the building, that's the unsafe or the structural defect.
I thought that Justice Bradley's question could have fallen in, and I think the Chief asked the same question, fell under operation when you sent the person up in the attic. It seems to me that could fall under the 4C situation.
But he didn't think so.
Well, if you're affirmatively operating an improvement, doing something, if it's...
building.
For one, I don't like the building example because when I think of an improvement being operated, I read 4C to have three categories. You either didn't do something, you affirmatively did something wrong, or you failed to look for it. And I think the operation was not intended to be read so broadly as operating the business, because if you read it that way, just like the earlier questions to, I believe, Attorney Gleisner, the rest of it has no effect.
What I was thinking is her example had a person sending somebody up. That's operation, different than in the Trollhagen case where someone came in, a patron who was skiing there. But, I mean, clearly that you could have this situation fall under 4C. I think if as the chief explained, they did change the floor, they did do something, you could have...
I believe, yes, there's going to be circumstances where you have done something that's operating under a reasonable definition of that, where you're negligent in operating and it's going to get around the statute of repose. Hypothetically, I suppose I could sit and ponder how that would affect Trollhagen. The best example I could think of was the ski lift, but in this circumstance, I don't think the operation element or that particular phrase is meant to address operating a floor drain, which is defective.
Are you finished?
I was just going to say, I think the reasonable one that possibly could apply here would be maintenance of the floor drain or inspection of it. And the facts that are in the record are that Trollhagen had employees daily doing inspections and maintenance.
Okay. We're asked to have an interaction between the Safe Place Statute and 893-89. And my understanding of the Safe Place Statute is it doesn't really set up the same standard as ordinary negligence does, but in fact you're required to make the place as safe as reasonably practicable, which is really more effort to make it safe. But 4C talks about negligence, so it's at a different standard than my view is of the Safe Place statute. Now, if I'm correct, is there really an interaction between the two statutes, since 101.11 does not require a showing of negligence, but 4C does?
I think there will be interactions, not necessarily in all cases. Safe Place, you can still have a Safe Place case involving negligence, as I believe Attorney Gleisner was discussing. If that's the case, yes, Safe Place does impose a higher duty of care for negligence. And in those cases which involve negligent Safe Place together, 4C will kick in because it deals with negligence. If it is a Safe Place claim that does not involve any negligence whatsoever, then you don't have perhaps the catch-all that 4C does. But that's not the case before us.
So what you're telling me is that you'd have to have a showing of negligence to fit within 4C, so the standard Safe Place claim that doesn't require negligence doesn't fit? Is that what you're saying?
I would say, yes, you have to have a showing of it, and I think that's what the terms of the statute say.
Why is that? Why do you suppose there's a different standard there under 4C?
Well, I think, I'm guessing, of course. My presumption would be, by using the term negligence, which is a fairly broad tort term, I think the legislature intended to cover circumstances where after an improvement is done, it's substantially completed, the owner is finished with it, the design and construction stage is over. If anything that owner does after that negligently fails to, sees a rusted drain, doesn't fix it, anything of that nature which may give rise to common law negligence or Safe Place claims, anything that owner does then gets around the builder statute repose. But like I mentioned earlier, that's not this case. This case is purely a structural defect, or if you don't like that term, it's a deficiency or a deficit in the structural improvement.
Safe Place, though, is a creates a higher standard of to show negligence. It's a higher standard rather than ordinary negligence. But a Safe Place claim is still, let me ask,
I thought that there was law that indicated a Safe Place claim is negligent, is negligence. It's a negligent cause of action.
I've interpreted, I think Barry mentioned that it Safe Place statute basically imposes a higher duty of care for negligence. So early in our briefs, we've always attributed this case, and when we've argued it, we've melded together Safe Place and common law negligence, which early on with the trial court was one of the arguments that's ever since reappeared. If they're willing to concede common law negligence claims are barred, why not Safe Place claims? I see my time is up.
Mr. Kobach, if I may, would you be in trouble if this ski chalet had been built in 2000?
Absolutely. If it would have been built in 2000, that means that bathroom would have been designed and constructed in 2000. Ms. Mayer would have been hurt easily within 10 years. The builder's statute of repose wouldn't apply in my mind.
But what I'm saying, was that condition unsafe?
If... perhaps I'm misunderstanding your question.
That the drain, the recessed drain, the slope of the floor, is this an unsafe condition?
My argument would be no. That issue was not resolved before the trial court or really factually developed simply because our argument was, if you assume it is, it doesn't matter because it's still a structural defect, a deficit with the improvement itself, which is covered by the builder's statute of repose. So that issue was not resolved, and if it does have to be reversed and go back to a trial, I'm sure that will be the focus. But at this point, for purposes of summary judgment, that was not a dispositive issue because if you even assume the plaintiffs were correct, that it was unsafe, defective, flawed, it didn't matter.
In Barry, the original construction had carpeting. Began to loosen up, gluing didn't work, and so what they did was they installed vinyl strips, so this was construction after the original construction. Does 893-89 cover reconstruction like this, repairs?
I think once you start dealing with reconstruction, you've now created a new improvement. For instance, if Trollhagen had modified this bathroom, and I actually had this case earlier before the Mayor case, if you have an improvement that is somehow changed during the course of 1974 to 2002, in my case it was bleachers that were taken down and they poured concrete underneath and put the bleachers back, they were changed. What you're doing is restarting
that post period. You've got a 10-year new statute. Yeah. So in Barry, would you have argued that the vinyl stripping was a structural defect, and that if there was a trip on it 10 years afterwards, no liability?
If it created a new improvement. There it was an addition of vinyl stripping. You know, if you're simply repairing something or maintaining it, there is a gray line there, and it's hard to delineate in certain fact circumstances, especially when you're talking about carpet, whether you're cleaning it, is that an improvement or is adding to it?
Here's my bottom line to you. I read your brief and I read the Court of Appeals decision. Do you agree with the Court of Appeals decision? I know you agree with their bottom line, but I don't have the sense that you agree with their decision.
I'll be frank with you. There are parts of the decision that concern me.
What parts concern you? What part would you agree with?
Okay. The notice issue, primarily because the way we had argued this case to the trial court, we argued this was always a structural defect. There was no unsafe condition associated with the structure. There were some arguments made by the plaintiffs at the trial court level saying, well, there's a lack of signs. That's an unsafe condition associated with the structure. The colors of the walls, those are unsafe conditions. Our argument to the trial court was, A, there's no facts supporting that from your own expert or from Mayor. Seabrook never said those were unsafe problems to a reasonable degree of certainty. But our alternative argument was, well, even if that was the case, there was no actual notice. Now, on the constructive notice issue, perhaps we would have lost that point, but our bigger point was that there are no unsafe conditions associated with the structure in this case.
So if you got an opinion from this court, you would really like it to just say this falls under the statute of repose because this is a structural defect, and even though the owner maintains it, and there might be expert witness that says this is unsafe for a place of employment, too bad, public policy, 10 years gone.
Absolutely, I wouldn't get into notice.
And, well, let's suppose that the owner here had inspected this, brought in a safety expert, and the safety expert said, man, you got a problem here. You got the problem that Justice Bradley indicated. And the owner says, well, that's nice, but I built this. It was structurally done, 10 years have passed. I don't have to do anything. You agree with that position then?
As the statutes are currently written, yes.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mr. Keene?
Madam Chief Justice, fellow justices, may it please the court, my name is Steve Kane, and I am here representing a number of amici, the Wisconsin Builders Association, the Associated Builders and Contractors of Wisconsin, Inc., the Associated General Contractors of Wisconsin, Inc., the American Institute of Architects, Wisconsin Chapter, and the American Council of Engineering Companies of Wisconsin, Inc. Now that I've used up all my time making my appearance.
Brilliant counsel.
This case appears to present the very type of stale claim that the statute of repose of Wisconsin was intended to bar. The bathroom drain in this case was constructed in 1976. To give that some perspective, I was 6 years old at the time. I've gone through a lot of changes since 1976. This bathroom drain underwent no changes whatsoever. There's nothing in the record to indicate problems were brought to the attention of the owner, and many of the issues we've been discussing today are pure hypotheticals for other cases that may come down the road. If a claim under the facts of this case, under the current statute, is allowed to go forward, the statute of repose would be rendered meaningless. It would tip off a circle of suits in which the owner sues the designers and or contractors that were involved in 1976 in putting this bathroom together, and Lord knows how difficult it would be to defend that type of case.
Why would it? Please, go ahead.
Ms. Kane, I'm not certain that the statute of repose would be meaningless in it. Let me ask you this question. I asked Mr. Gleisner earlier whether or not you could have construction defects that did not go to the issue of safety as defined in 101, I don't have it in front of me, but as safety is defined in the
111?
Statute. No, safety, as it's defined in 101.01 sub 13. That's where safety is defined. And as I understand the safe place statutes kick in when an issue of safety is involved. So my question once again is, can you have construction defects that occur that do not go to the issue of safety?
I think you can have construction defects.
And if that is the case, can't you read the two statutes together where the statute of repose covers types of construction defects that do not bring into question safety issues, because the safe place statute kicks in a different duty, a different requirement for ongoing repair. And if you have knowledge of an unsafe condition, isn't there a duty under the safe place statute to repair? And it's got to be unsafe as opposed to just a, quote, defect.
I would say the statute of repose does address issues as to safety. I mean, it wouldn't be barring claims that it caused injury or damage were it not focusing on types of defects that could cause safety problems. The issue that I see coming from that would be that you're addressing the control negligence aspects, the aspects that go to an owner's duties and responsibilities after substantial completion. And certainly those duties and responsibilities are spelled forth in the Safe Place statute. And there is an exception in the statute of repose under 4C that I believe encompasses the owner's duties under the Safe Place statute, but only the duties with regard to continuing repair and or maintenance. That third duty that is identified in the Safe Place statute to safely construct, I believe, falls away after 10 years.
But the duty to repair, and that's why I asked the question, if the owner were to have knowledge of a defect that went to the issue of safety, then under the Safe Place statute and under 4C, wouldn't the owner have a responsibility to repair that defect?
Well, if within 10 years, the owner would have such a duty.
But what about the ongoing duty under the Safe Place statute? And the reason I'm pressing the question is, as I read the statute of repose, you can have issues that may or may not fall in. In fact, this may or may not be the case. I don't know, since we've heard that there's no real evidence as to whether or not safety is involved here. I think the courts will assume that. Is that correct?
We can assume it for purpose.
All right, so we're assuming for purpose. But the question is, was this drain, in fact, safe? And I think that goes to Justice Foster's question. If this drain was designed in a manner that was safe, and this was a fluke accident when she stumbled, arguably the statute of repose would kick in. But if it was unsafe, as I understand petitioner's argument, well, now you're in a different ballgame because you've got that duty to repair because of the safety issue. And that's why I keep going back to that safety question that kicks into the statute of repose, because I'm not sure just having a defect is enough to get you under the safe place statute.
I think what that goes to is how the case is presented. And from what I've read of this case wasn't presented in that way. Vocational experts weren't brought forth to say you know, the owner should have known, you know, through the course of their involvement with the property over this number of years, that this condition was an unsafe condition within the property, i.e., some information suggesting constructive notice or something that was creating control negligence on the part of the owner while the owner was still there. But the record in this case is completely barren and devoid of any such evidence. But our contention is that to the extent anything is preserved by the statute of repose, it only goes to the control negligence obligations of the owner, which this Court in the Funk decision, you know, the original justification for the statute of repose that was brought forth for excluding owners from its protections was control. We as contractors and architects and engineers, our position was simply when we turn over the keys, when the property is substantially completed, we no longer have any control over this, and therefore it's fair to exclude owners from this statute because owners don't have any control. When owners enter the mix and have entered the picture, but in Funk, in reviewing that justification and explaining it, this Court said, well, architects and engineers would have no liability for that control negligence anyway. It's not their obligation. It's not their duty. There are other duties that may be owed by the owner. I think what the legislature has done here is taken a look at the Safe Place statute, and in 4C has drawn up a limited exception to encompass claims to the extent they fall within the maintenance, operation, or inspection obligations of an owner going forward. However, in this case, the record on summary judgment was entirely barren of any arguments or causal arguments on that type of claim. And it's the plaintiff's burden, even on summary judgment, to present evidence in that regard, and it didn't occur in this case.
This is the tension that that I feel, that under the Safe Place statute, there is a continuing duty, non-delegable, some of our cases say, to, you know, have a property as safe as it reasonable, as the nature will reasonably permit. And that's an ongoing responsibility under our Safe Place statute that's been in effect, you know, since early 1900s. And yet every other statute of repose that comes to mind, and maybe my mind is just not creative enough right now, deals with more of a single act or a single series of acts, you know, whether it be an architect, whether it be a malpractice claim of a professional, whether it be maybe even timber trespass or whatever statute, cases that have statute of limitations. I cannot think of any other statute of limitations that would arguably limit a continuing duty. You see, and that's where the tension is. How can you both have a continuing duty under one statute and cut that duty off on another?
I think what the legislature has indicated is there is a limited continuing duty to the extent that 4C exception applies. And we haven't been presented with any evidence in this case that this is a 4C exception case. It just wasn't presented that way. Other cases down the road may be presented that way. But those types of claims have to fall within the 4C exception in the 4C language, and they have to be the types of claims that are not the responsibility or even arguably the responsibility of those involved in the initial construction, i.e. the contractors or architects. Otherwise, that will throw the entire structure of the statute of repose into disarray.
Counselor, so if I understand what you're saying that no expert witness testified that they knew or should have known they should have taken remedial efforts on this drain to change its relationship to the surrounding floor?
Could you repeat the question?
You said there was no evidence presented relative to a negligence claim for the maintenance, operation, or inspection of the drain. And my question to you was, just so I'm sure I understand, because I haven't read all the affidavits, that there was no expert testimony that said a defendant should have known that it should have remediated the position of this drain relative to the floor.
Now, I can't claim to be familiar with every aspect of the record any more than most of the justices can at this point. I haven't reviewed the expert deposition transcripts, but my understanding was there may have been some criticisms of the location rendered by the expert. However, he couldn't place a causal connection on his criticisms between that and the injury that occurred.
Okay.
And I am out of time.
Why are you and your clients interested? This is over 10 years. Even if the owner was found liable, let us suppose, there would be no indemnity from your people, would there?
There wouldn't be. But what we're concerned about is protecting the slippery slope that could occur and flow from this case. Mm-hmm. If the 4C exemption or if the language in 2A begins to be rendered meaningless, it's only a matter of time before we're all back in the position we were in before the statute was enacted.
How would you suggest that this court write the opinion that is favorable to your clients?
I think the Court of Appeals opinion was appropriately put together, and I think it did a fantastic job of taking both existing court precedent, taking the language of the two statutes, and harmonizing all of them together.
So you agree that this structure, or defect, or whatever you want to call it, fell within the distinction made in the safe place statutes between structural defect associated with a condition, whatever that language is, and structural defect, three that boil. Text set forth. You agree with that?
Based on the record before the court, I think the only evidence presented was that it was a structural defect.
Well, but the Court of Appeals had two prongs to its decision.
Oh, in terms of the second prong and unsafe condition associated with the structure?
Mm-hmm.
I think the Court of Appeals was correct there as well. I think the notice issue seems to be an issue that's out there that's probably beyond the interests of my particular clients mm-hmm. on this case. But it does appear that the record is devoid of any actual notice.
Which was part of the plaintiff's proof, but is there anything in the record that shows that there was notice or no notice? Isn't the record just blank on that issue?
I believe it is blank, and that's why this makes it a case where it has to be a construction defect because that's all that was presented. And because that's all that was presented, this is a case and claim that falls within the statute of repose.
How would there be notice in a case like this? The drain is at the middle of a little hole in the middle of the floor. They clean it every day. What other notice would there be?
Some notice that it was an unsafe condition.
Was there any discovery about past people falling in the hole?
That I do not know, and will be something to, I think, address for the other attorneys when they step back up.
Chief, if I may, mm-hmm. maybe your answer is you don't know.
I don't know. Is
just
the best.
I was going to go into constructive notice and our case law on constructive notice because I'm a little concerned that you might think that the Court of Appeals got it right or you don't. They don't have it right, but I'm concerned about their notice discussion seems to negate our case law that length of time in and of itself can constitute constructive notice. But you might not be prepared to address that.
It's not an issue I've looked into here in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Gross.
Oh,
I'll take up my rebuttal remarks with this issue about the record and whether or not it was void of evidence of notice of a potential problem. The comment was made on several occasions that the record was void of evidence of a problem or notice of a problem. Mr. Kane suggested that one of the experts might have ruminated about location being a problem, but didn't give any opinion about cause or it being a contributing factor. I think that's not true. I'll not read to the court, but I'll direct the court's attention to page 9 of the respondent's brief, where they include a portion of Larry Seibelich's deposition transcript, where he talks about the location of the drain being inappropriate and that that was a contributing factor. I think that issue then dovetails with the court's plural possessive other concern about how that issue plays out. I think the question is one of credibility, ultimately, for the jury to consider whether Mr. Rockford or his representative employees at Trollhagen, who claim that they weren't on notice that this was a problem, is true or not. And it would be our submission to a jury that that's not a credible claim, that if after 30 years you've seen this, despite nobody falling, and I think it was Justice Prosser asked whether there's any evidence of that in the record, and there is. The testimony from Mr. Rockford was that no one had ever fallen outside this bathroom. You know, I wonder how he might know whether that's true. Obviously, it might be true that nothing was ever reported to him, and I'm aware of nothing else to suggest that anyone had ever fallen there. But it is for the jury to conclude whether it was credible for these people to suggest that they weren't on notice or this didn't appear to them to be dangerous.
Mr. Gross, I've looked at what you referred to on page 9 of the respondent's brief. I've also looked at Appendix 111 of the trial court's decision that summarized Larry Seibelich's opinion. And my question once again goes to the record. Was there any evidence or any findings by the trial court that went to the issue of safety or unsafe conditions? Did anything come in that talked about whether or not this drain was unsafe?
Well, is the court excluding location, or is the court excluding Ms. Mayer's testimony that in her reality it was unsafe because her boot dropped down and that's what caused her to become unfooted? There was Ms. Mayer's testimony to that effect. There was evidence it was unsafe in that regard. And there is Mr. Seibelich's testimony as an architect that it was a problem both in that regard and in the location in the pathway of people leaving the stall. So, yes, there was evidence.
I think he indicated that it was a mistake. And maybe I'm parsing words here, but I'm trying to get really towards the... It's one thing to have a mistake or a, quote, defect. It's another thing to have a defect that is of an unsafe nature. And so I'm trying to focus in on the safety aspect, whether there's any evidence in the record. And your argument, your response would be Ms. Mayer's testimony.
That and Mr. Seibelich's testimony, and you know, I don't know exactly what he meant by the word mistake, but I would argue, obviously, that he attributed it to that word, notions of unsafety.
Well, isn't notice something that you'd have to receive in some way or constructive notice before the incident happened? Isn't that what we're talking about?
Yes.
Before it happened.
Yes.
Before
the accident happened. Yes.
But your position is it's a jury question, not one of law.
That's my position.
Summary judgment.
That's my position.
If I hear the opposition correctly, they say that you can do it on summary judgment in this case because you've got nothing in there to show notice at all. And I gather your response would be that you might have constructive notice because of the length of time if you can show that this was defective.
That would be my position.
Didn't he also testify that this was the slope and the positioning of the drain in the floor was not contrary to local building codes?
I think he said that there were no building codes that spoke to the issue, but it was... I'd have to I'd have to pull it again and read it. But, yes, he did mention that there were no building codes that specifically said that this was problematic.
So how do you want this court to write the opinion, other than you're winning?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. How do you want this court to write an opinion that makes sense under these two statutes and yet enables you to succeed?
I would like the court to tell us whether or not 893, the statute of repose, I forgot the statute number, 893.82 or 92, whatever. 89, thank you. I'd like for the court to tell us that that statute only applies to safe place claims against owners with respect to their participation in the original construction decisions, but that 893 does not apply to their ongoing obligations because the policy of the safe place law in this state trumps the limited policy of this statute of repose. Then, with respect to the maintenance and repair issues, which are the other two obligations imposed by owners under the safe place statute, and the notice issue, I would like the court to find in the alternative or in addition, whichever would be an appropriate grammatical way to phrase it, that it is a question of fact whether or not Trollhagen had constructive notice of the problem. And that would, I think the court also is probably going to have to spend some time distinguishing Cohen, K-O-H-N, and I can address that if the court would like, but in summary fashion, I think Cohen is distinguishable simply because the court did not have to wrestle with these problems of the interplay or the potential interplay between safe place law and the statute of repose.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I want to thank both Mr. Bros and Mr. Gleisner and Mr. Kovac and Mr. Keene for their excellent arguments today on the statute of repose and the safe place statute issues we haven't directly dealt with in prior cases. That concludes our argument in 04AP 1252, Julie Mayer versus Trollhagen Ski Resort. The court is in recess until its next oral argument in about a week, and the court will meet at 3:20 in closed conference. We are in recess.